Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point Market Woe, a Greenspan mea culpa and full lather politics this week. His numbers looked bad, but from Florida to Colorado to here, New Hampshire, John McCain insisted it can still be done.
I'm asking you to come out one more time. Get out the vote. Get him out, and we'll win, and we'll have a great election night here.
Barack Obama, before heading to Hawaii and his ailing grandmother, looked to redefine McCain's favorite Joe.
He's not fighting for Joe the plumber. He's fighting for Joe the hedge fund manager.
And in historic testimony, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress that he couldn't believe his ideas had failed.
Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief.
Shocked disbelief. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining us today from Washington is Nina Easton, D.C. Bureau Chief for Fortune Magazine and commentator for Fox News. Nina, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Washington, Matt Bies, celebrated political writer for the New York Times Magazine. His cover story Sunday was, Will Gun-Toting Church-Going White Guys Pull the Lever for Barack Obama? Matt, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. This is Jack the Bloviator. I'm the neighbor of Peaches the Exotic Dancer.
Oh, and Joe the Plumber will be over in a minute to fix the... Okay, great. Great. I want to go straight to Greenspan with all of you. That was some kind of testimony yesterday. I mean, I heard people watching it on the news and saying, boy, they're pretty tough on an old guy. He's 82 now, and he was really, really taking the heat. But let's listen for just a second. Here's Henry Waxman, California Democrat, chairs the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, former Fed chairman, of course, Alan Greenspan sitting there, Waxman pressing him on whether he could have done more to prevent the subprime mess.
Do you feel that your ideology pushed you to make decisions that you wish you had not made?
Well, remember that what an ideology is a conceptual framework with the way people deal with reality. Everyone has one. You have to exist, you need an ideology. The question is whether it is accurate or not. And what I'm saying to you is, yes, I found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by that fact.
Nina Easton, holy moly, we'll turn to presidential politics, but talk about, I mean, this is the reigning ideology for decades now, and here's the guru, the maestro, as Bob Woodward had it, saying, I found a flaw, and the whole market's all over the world just going down in flames right and left.
Well, I think it's also sort of a Washington story, which is that we put these people on a pedestal, the great oracle, and then we sort of relish watching them fall. You know, it's funny because there's a lot of blame to go around for this crisis. The Democrats could be blamed for their ideology in failing to regulate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which was at least as large of a contributor to this disaster as Alan Greenspan. But of course, the Democrats were running the committee yesterday, and they got to have their say. But, what a fall for this guy who was just untouchable at one point.
Matt Bies, how about it? Just Washington relishing the great one brought low? I mean, it seems to me there's a lot of facts on the ground out there. This isn't just a personal moment of soul searching for Alan Greenspan. We've got wealth all over the world just vanishing.
Well, that's exactly right. And while I think, it was kind of shocking to hear him sit there and take the blame partially for this, at least he did that, which is kind of rare in Washington, right? How many times do you see somebody of that level of importance sit before a congressional committee and say, I screwed up? Obviously the ramifications here are quite grave. But I think, Nina makes a good point, is we put people on a pedestal, and would Alan Greenspan's ideology have created for him such celebrity and such respect had his ideology been to restrict wealth rather than spread it? I mean, there were a lot of people who readily went along with this version of the world because it was a really good time for a lot of people. And, what comes up generally does come down.
It felt good on the way up here. He is talking about the whole intellectual edifice. Let's listen.
This modern risk management paradigm held sway for decades. The whole intellectual edifice, however, collapsed in the summer of last year because the data inputted into the risk management models generally covered only the past two decades, a period of euphoria.
A period of euphoria and nowhere to be seen right now. Jack Beatty, a person on a pedestal, or are we really talking about a kind of sea change here? I mean, Alan Greenspan himself saying an ideology here found with a great big flaw hitting us now.
Yes, and it's the ideology of Reaganism, of, you know, government is the problem, private markets, uber alles, regulation, go light on regulation, the hidden hand will take care of everything. Well, it doesn't. It hasn't. And, you know, Greenspan said self-interest should have ruled. Well, of course, self-interest is part of the problem. What failed was intelligence. And John Galbraith, I think, put very well what happens. He said speculation buys out the available intelligence. That in institution after institution, it's the excess of self-interest that buys out intelligence. And they continually make these colossal misjudgments with people's whole fortunes and lives. So I think it's the smash up of a whole ideology, an ideology that with Greenspan began with Ayn Rand over 50 years ago and runs through Goldwater and into Reagan and Bush, and it's now on the rocks. And I think that was a really historic moment yesterday.
Can I push back here?
Please,
a little bit,
Nina, please.
You know, let's go back to, again, this question of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These two institutions, which, by the way, some Clinton economists in the late 90s said, these are a disaster waiting to happen. And Democrats like Barney Frank, who, you know, head of the Financial Services Committee, who, you know, protected Fannie Mae, which, by the way, gave a lot of money to community groups that they supported.
Yeah, yeah,
they refused to put those institutions under control. And now I was talking to a Clinton economist yesterday. They encouraged the subprime lending mess. And you can't just say that it's, you know, conservative philosophy and deregulation. That's not the only piece of this.
Yeah, okay, but Alan Greenspan was the one who resisted in the mid-90s bringing these, you know, credit default swaps under control, very explicitly pushed back against regulation there. I mean, there's a big debate over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And so did some Clinton economists push back against that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my point is there's a lot of blame to go around, and it's not just Alan Greenspan and, you know, deregulation. And again, it wasn't so much deregulation. It was a failure to regulate forward is what the problem
well,
was.
Well, I wonder, Matt Bayh, the American people will have the final say on this. How do you sense and hear them processing this economic meltdown still going down this week in global markets as they think about the future, who stands for what, where they want to put their vote, you know, their push going forward, Matt?
Oh, well, why give the American people the final say? Tom, we have Washington pundits for that.
Come on.
You know, I think obviously it has a major impact on the presidential campaign. I think it's been a huge factor in the poll numbers rising for Barack Obama. I think people who were uncomfortable with him a couple of months ago are looking for a way to get comfortable with him because they believe he represents change on this front. And look, I want to say I agree with Nina to a large extent on this, that in my mind, this is not, I mean, we all see the world through our particular lens, but to my mind, this is not a failure so much or strictly of ideology as it is a generational failure. It's a generation of leaders who have, you know, frankly, in every aspect of government, this post-60s generation of leaders has simply failed to address long-term concerns in every area of government. They have been self-absorbed and they have been short-term. And they were short-term and self-absorbed in this area as well, and we're paying the price for it.
Jack Beatty, everybody's self-absorbed. That's spreading the wealth of blame around a lot. We have lived in a period of a certain ideology. I've got to say, I'm still struck by Greenspan himself saying, this was my ideology. I found a flaw right in the middle of it where I never expected it. The self-interest not guarding us here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of blame to go around, but Nina, I don't go along with you on Fannie and Freddie, and more particularly, studies don't go along with you. Look at the study the Center for American Progress did on this, and they come
Jack, that's a
And they come to the conclusion that Fannie and Freddie were late to the party. They got into this in 2005, and they got into it under pressure from their stockholders because the big private firms were involved in the subprime thing, and that their contribution to the disaster may be on the order of 25%, because the firms that are failing, of course, are the private banks, and they're the ones that did the main packaging of these instruments. But beyond that question, I mean, I think that I don't see any generational narcissism here. This is a failure of a set of ideas that Americans went for so long as they seemed to work. Periodically, Americans have these periods. The 1920s was one where, you know, the business of America is business, and keep away from the markets, and don't regulate Wall Street. And by gosh, Herbert Hoover, as Secretary of Commerce, was worrying about it. And Calvin Coolidge said, let the Wonder Boy deal with it when he was elected in 1928. Well, it all came crash. And this happens again and again in American history when government doesn't do its job of protecting the consumer and the investor.
Nina, have we found the edge of that world, looked over the edge? Nina?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say to Jack, I mean, you know, citing a liberal think tank's study on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I mean, there's
not
some
your
perspective
plumb line.
There.
Okay.
And, you know, you talk to mainstream economists, you talk to some people around Barack Obama who think that Fannie and Freddie had a lot to do with this. And I would ask Jack, where would you put all of those homeowners who borrowed way above their means and then took out credit card debt and folded, like, apparently 40% of credit card debt was folded into home mortgages.
Hold the thought.
We'd put
them underwater, Nina. That's, I guess, where a whole lot of them are right now. Nina Easton with Fortune, Matt Bai with the New York Times, Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Here's John McCain in an interview on to Fox News, Nina, with Chris Wallace, asking him if Barack Obama was a socialist.
Do you think that Senator Obama is a socialist? Do you think that his plans are socialism?
I think his plans are redistribution of the wealth. He said it himself. We need to spread the wealth around. Now,
is that
that's
socialism?
That's one of the tenets of socialism, but it's more the liberal left, which he's always been on. He's always been in the left lane of American politics.
The left lane of American politics in Richmond, Virginia. On Wednesday, Barack Obama rejected McCain's tag that he's a socialist.
Was John McCain a socialist back in 2000 when he opposed the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans? Because all I'm trying to do is reverse those so that we can give relief to people who really need help.
Nina, who's what here? You wrote just a couple of weeks ago about John McCain's mortgage plans. You said, took the already listing ship of free market republicanism, it keeled over and began a long journey to the bottom of the political seas on his policy. Who's what here, Nina?
Well, I think John McCain, here's what I think. I think that John McCain's best case against Barack Obama, we thought, was that he was a liberal Democrat. But in fact, he's having trouble making that case partly because, you know, whoops, we are, you know, Republican administration already quasi-nationalized our banking industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it falls flat on that. B, what was really interesting to me this week was the Joe the Plumber thing, because I thought that spread the wealth pulling out spread the wealth and spreading that word around. Mm-hmm. I thought that could have been John McCain's best weapon. But in fact, the polls didn't move. I mean, if anything, Obama gained in his lead. And there was a Fox News poll this week that showed at least as many people think that's a good idea, spreading the wealth, as a bad idea. So what that says to me is that there really is a kind of tectonic shift in the zeitgeist of the American public. And partly, I mean, we could almost lay it at the feet of Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, because, you know, this Republican administration has, you know, has created this historical intervention in the financial markets. So suddenly they're using big government, and big government doesn't look so bad anymore. So I think it's a huge moment in our political history.
Matt Bai, we're counting on your reporting from out in the hustings here. What about the spread the wealth mantra being tossed back and forth here, and how American voters are looking at that? I mean, there has been, and everybody knows it now, we saw it in all those giant salaries on Wall Street, just for starters, a gigantic concentration of wealth in recent decades. So is it so weird if Americans aren't shocked by a spread the wealth message?
Well, you know, Tom, I'm a baseball fan, and in baseball you often see guys who throw, you know, 95, 98 miles per hour when they're 25 or 30 years old, and they're blowing people away, and then they get to be 38, 39 years old, they're throwing the same pitch, and it doesn't seem to be scaring anybody. And I think that's a little bit of what's been happening to McCain here, is that this panic button worked in every election going back for 20 years, and he's hitting the same button, and nothing's happening. And they, you know, he's throwing that fastball, and they're hitting it. And you know, I do think that represents some, that is the result of some kind of change out there, is an insecurity. But I'm not sure I would go as far as Nina on this. I don't know that it's a tectonic shift. I actually think this is pretty, I think people, voters, and the voters I talk to certainly would confirm this, pretty much stay in the same place on this, in my view. I think America is a pretty centrist, pragmatic country, and people pretty much want government to help them when things aren't going well. They want government to right the ship, but they want government to get out of the way when things are in fact going well. They want a government that doesn't overreach in their lives, but that doesn't disappear when it has a vital role to play. And what really changes is the political climate. What really changes is that one side or the other overreaches, or the pendulum swings too far the other way, and the public kind of smacks it back. And I think in this case we have, you know, quite obviously overreached in some way. We have serious consequences from a period in which there's been very little government oversight and regulation and very little desire for government. And so I think that is swinging back in the favor of the Democratic message. But I don't think the American people move on this all that much.
How do you see Barack Obama reading it? You were writing last week. You were recently up, you know, in his big white airplane with the red, white, and blue all on the tail, 35,000 feet sitting right across from him. How is he reading this? Does he see a mandate for significant change, radical change, to push the pendulum in a big way? Or is he riding that centrist perception of American politics? How do you read him, Matt?
I think the latter, and I was struck by how clearly he seemed to see this. I spoke with him for about 40 minutes on his plane, and his point to me was not, you know, I've broken through, I've convinced everyone that I'm a different kind of Democrat, I'm building a huge mandate. I mean, he had a pretty sober view of this, which is, look, And as we were talking on the plane, the market was in fact crashing. That was the one huge day that started this all. And he was saying, essentially, you know, people have a lot of insecurity economically, and they, you know, they're hearing our message, and they're, you know, they're scared, and they believe that I represent the kind of change they want, and they want change. But I've not bridged that, you know, cultural divide. I've not changed the way they perceive Democrats. I've not solved the values problem, the cultural fight that he and I were talking about, and effectively saying, you know, I understand now that people may vote for my policies, but that as president, I would have to, you know, they would have to get to know me, and I'd have to continue to earn their trust. And I think that's it was a very interesting, surprising thing to hear, and I think very important, because if you remember when George W. Bush came in 2000 with the thinnest of margins, and a lot of people believe there was no margin at all, and they behaved as if they owned the place, as if they had a massive mandate. Maybe I think that was frankly a conscious strategy, because they felt they'd be steamrolled and delegitimized if they didn't behave as if they'd won a very solid victory in the election. Obama does not at this point, you know, see the poll numbers as that kind of validation, but simply a vote for change.
Of course, he'll be facing his own pushback if he wins. And then beyond that, reality just sits out there and keeps talking to us in a very loud voice through the economy recently. Let's begin to hear from our listeners. Washington, Virginia. Tanya, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Hi. And your guest.
Hi.
So there's so many issues here to comment on, but I'll try to keep it brief. I think it's blatant to everybody now that we're all interdependent. And so given that obvious state of affairs, I'm sort of shocked at Greenspan's shock that selfishness doesn't really work. People like the Dalai Lama always say, you know, if you want your own happiness, you have to look at someone else's welfare. And I don't think that this is isolated to just, you know, emotions and so forth. I think it's also applicable to economics.
Tanya, we've got a terrible line, but we hear you're saying you're shocked that Greenspan's shocked. Let us run with that. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling because I have a background. I'm a PhD in math and could have pursued a career in quantitative analysis and became self-educated in that because, you know, there was a big party going on. It looked like an opportunity, and it didn't take too long to realize that this thing was a big house of cards waiting to fall. And so your question is, are you surprised by what's going on? I'm not at all. I started, glad I didn't pursue that career, started shorting the market, didn't buy a house, completely avoided the whole thing. And so I'm afraid to say that, you know, things have just started now. You've got two narratives that are well represented on your show now. This is a regulation perspective versus, mm-hmm. This is poor people buying houses that can't afford perspective. And that, I'm sorry, but that is just a dumb argument. The issues here are hedge funds leveraged at 20-30 to 1. Leverage, yep, is great on the way up, but it's really, really bad on the way down. Mm-hmm. All the former iBanks with similar kinds of leverage, no regulatory oversight, institutionally stupid things. We should be happy at the end of this if we end up with a Japan scenario, Japan's Nikkei being, you know,
Nikkei 10 lost years, today, but not worse than that.
Nikkei is 7,000 now. It was 40,000 in 1989. This is a 25-year thing for them. Unless we start, there's a lot of insolvent banks and institutions out there. Unless we step in and start, you know, basically dismantling all the zombie banks and all the zombie corporations that loaded up on all this bad debt, it's going to get real bad. And
Steve, we've got it. Let me get one more right here from Susie. Susie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to say that I'm delighted to see that Alan Greenspan is getting his comeuppance. I have been enraged at him from the minute the Bush administration took office and he went out of his apolitical position and supported their tax cut, which he should never have done. For years and years, when the Democrats were in office, he pretended to be apolitical. The minute Bush comes into office, he goes and helps his friends in their political quest. I think he went on to do that by keeping interest rates very low until after the 2004 election to make the economy look good to help George Bush stay in office. I think it's a delight that he's getting his comeuppance. He deserves it. I'm glad he's alive to get it, and I'm alive to see it.
Thank you, Susie. It was a rough road there yesterday. Nina Easton, how about it? Barack Obama pushes back and says, look, John McCain was against these tax cuts in 2000 that he's looking to extend now. So how can he call me socialist for when he stood against him in the first place himself? Effective argument, Nina?
It's always been an effective argument against John McCain that he's, you know, flip-flopped on the tax thing. That's always been a vulnerability of his. But I wanted to just go back to your callers. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make clear that I think there's a lot of blame that's legitimately placed on Alan Greenspan. But I also just want to make clear, and there's a lot of blame to be placed on, you know, greed on Wall Street. Plenty of blame. But that's not the only place that there's blame. And there's also blame, again, on, I was talking to a banker yesterday, a Democratic banker, by the way, a politically active Democratic banker, who was saying that 40% of their subprime mortgages that are underwater were Community Reinvestment Act. They were given because of Community Reinvestment Act pressures. If you look at the mortgages, and again, speaking to your caller who was talking about, you know, the hedge funds and so on and the greed on Wall Street.
And the leverage root of this, and the size
and the
of it
leverage,
that Warren Buffett
exactly.
calls the nuclear, you know, meltdown dynamic.
Exactly. But the root of it, keep in mind, what caused this was, it's just basic. It's mortgages. And when you look at the percent of mortgages that were given to people who put no money down or literally no money down, and community organizations help pay for fees or finance fees, and, you know, they didn't have any, you know, they just weren't, they were put into situations that, you know, by everybody's blame, but also their own.
You are really buying that root of it. Even Alan Greenspan didn't buy that root of it.
Reed's, No, read. I mean, read these cases. There's a terrific piece in the Wall Street Journal that looked that looked at homeowners.
No, I've seen the argument,
in the California housing market. I'm not talking about an argument, Tom. I'm talking about facts on the ground. You can make any argument you want.
Well, there are a lot of them out
there. You do have to look at the facts on the ground. You have to look at the actual facts, and the facts show that there is blame to go around everywhere, and we can't. And we fool ourselves if we're just going to say it. You know, it's just green on Wall Street. By the way, Barack Obama, if you look at his speeches, he gave a speech, a week ago, Monday, in which he said, he is now saying, everybody, a lot of people were living beyond their means, not just Wall Street. So he's picking up on this as well. It's not just, you know, right-wing rhetoric. It's reality.
Yeah, nobody's saying just Wall Street, but it's a big mural out there, a lot of pieces to go around. I'm just curious that you're coming back so repeatedly to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Even Greenspan saying there's a lot more going on than that. Let's go to Greenwich, Connecticut. And Matt, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks again for the call. I think there's a lot of correct arguments we made on both sides of this debate right now, Tom. Mm. You know, again, speaking from the perspective of Greenwich and Wall Street from 2000 when the markets were riding high when I ran a fund. And then
what kind of fund, Matt? Are you a hedge fund manager?
It was a hedge fund.
Okay.
Public equities, margin, yep. Trade, leverage. The same type of mortgage mentality on Main Street you see on Wall Street when you're doing margin to buy public equities. What I guess I'm seeing, though, from the Knickerbocker Club to the Greenwich Country Day School, but also to Beverly, Mass. And mainstream America, I agree with Nia's point that there is this sense of what really measures success and what are we after. And there is this weird, irrational sense from the middle class to the upper class of needing more and more stuff and things. And this is a much more philosophical, maybe social argument to make, that we have to step back on the larger question here. It's why do we need this kind of affirmation, whether it's a $200 million salary or a $500,000 condo that we don't deserve or can't afford? And I see that across the board in this country. And I think what's going to happen now is a massive correction in terms of not just how much we spend, but how we measure what really it means to be successful. And I don't know how you legislate that, and I'm not quite sure how you put, you know, how you kind of talk to that in a political paradigm. But that is a much larger question, and it hasn't really solved itself in the 1850s, the 1950s, the 2008, that we really as a people, as a country, particularly the United States, having lived overseas, there is a difference in this country in particular about how we look at success and what we're willing to do to get that type of success, whether it means mortgaging ourselves to the hilt to appear successful. And I think that's the larger question that Americans are going to have to ask.
Matt, we've got it. Jack Beattie, here's Matt in Greenwich, leading us back to the aesthetic life. What do you say?
Right. Well, you know, people wanting to live in a house. I don't know that that's some sort of sybaritic desire. And you know, I
don't. Some pretty big ones out there, Jack.
Right. But, you know, this idea of the Community Reinvestment Act passed in 1979, and now it's having these. That's a canard. But let me just make a point. It's true that people got into mortgages they couldn't afford. Why couldn't they afford them? Because we are in a low-wage economy. Because we were in a low-wage, practically no-union economy. Because people can barely make it. And because they wanted their piece of the American dream. And because these Wall Street chefs of possibility and fantasy said, oh, don't worry. Regulation doesn't require you to have 25% down. You look good to me. We'll give you a loan. And on it went. But that desire to own a home but having nothing, the crisis is the having nothing. And that's the chronic crisis that, you know, it isn't the Bush economy that's failed.
Nothing?
Or very little. It isn't the Bush economy that's failed. It's the American economy that is producing these low-wage jobs and limiting the opportunity for people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Wardrobe jokes, Will Ferrell, and an Indian moonshot this week. John Stewart went to town on Sarah Palin's shopping bill. He was curious about that little red jacket she's been wearing.
How do you spend $150,000 on clothes in 2 months? What, do you buy the original Thriller jacket off of eBay?
Will Ferrell reprised his George Bush impression for Saturday Night Live.
I come to you tonight in the midst of a very important election between two very qualified candidates, the hot lady and the Tiger Woods guy.
And after China's recent spacewalk, up-and-coming India blasted off on a mission to orbit the moon.
4, 3, 2, 1,
one.
Yes.
Plus two.
The vehicle has lifted off.
Vehicle has lifted off.
Vehicle has lifted off.
The vehicle has lifted off, and that's India going to orbit the moon. We're looking at a week in the news, layoffs, more market hemorrhaging, the presidential campaign heading into its last week. Nina Easton is here from Fortune Magazine, Washington editor there, and Fox News. Matt Bies here from the New York Times Magazine, author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, in the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Our own Jack Beatty is here, musicians stepping up this week. Here's Hank Williams in a new radio ad airing in Virginia and other swing states where John McCain is pushing hard. Hank Williams Jr. criticizing Barack Obama, what he calls his lack of understanding of small-town America, urging listeners to support McCain.
Hello, this is Hank Williams Jr. When Barack Obama said folks like you and me were bitter and clinging to guns and religion, I knew he just doesn't understand small-town America. We love our God, and we love our guns, especially handed down from our grandfathers. And we resent it when liberals like Obama question our way of life. Don't be bitter. Vote McCain.
Not to put too fine a point on it, a new radio ad airing in the swing state, believe it or not, of Indiana. Indiana homeboy John Mellencamp, known for his small-town roots in the Hoosier State, defended Barack Obama on tax policies and job growth plans.
Over the last 8 years, thousands of Hoosiers have seen their jobs sent out of this country. John McCain will keep giving tax breaks to companies shipping American jobs overseas. Barack Obama gets it. He sees the value in American-made products and a strong American labor force. He'll end tax breaks for companies shipping our jobs overseas and give a hard-working family a break. This is John Mellencamp, and I'm proud to support Barack Obama, because whether you live in a small town or a big city, it's time for a change.
John Mellencamp there. Don't be bitter. Vote McCain versus Barack Obama gets it. Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, and Pete. Pete, you're on the air.
Hi. Tom, how are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, I think the gap between the rich and the poor has a lot to do with this. And the last guest you were talking to there was hitting on that point. And these high compensation packages for CEOs and the golden parachutes and all that, they're getting rewarded for failure. And they just keep pressing it and pressing it and pressing it, while the common ordinary person is just getting in worse shape all the time. We don't have a living minimum wage in this country. We have a minimum wage that is okay for high school kids that are living at home, but you can't support a family on it.
Do you think Barack Obama is a socialist, Pete?
I don't know. I doubt that he is a socialist. I think he is what I would call a fair-minded person who sees a lot of things wrong in this country and wants to change them. And it starts with in D.C. because D.C. needs major surgery, not $700 billion Band-Aids.
Pete, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Joe Biden saying this week that Barack Obama will be tested. He warned that some kind of crisis, engineered maybe, will occur in the first 6 months of an Obama term in office. Excuse the audio quality here. It was at a fundraiser.
Mark my words. It will not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama like they did John Kennedy. The world is looking. We're about to elect a brilliant 47-year-old President of the United States of America. Remember I said standing here, don't remember anything else I said. Watch, we're going to have an international crisis, a generated crisis, to test the mettle of this guy.
Crisis to test the mettle of this guy. Sarah Palin picked right up on that on Tuesday in Reno, Nevada, criticizing Biden's comments. Let's listen.
Did you hear that Senator Biden said at a fundraiser on Sunday, he guaranteed that if Barack Obama is elected, that we will face an international crisis within the first 6 months of their administration. He told his Democrat donors to mark his words, it will happen, that there were at least four or five scenarios that would place our country at risk in an Obama administration. I guess we got to say, well, thanks for the warning, Joe.
Okay, Sarah Palin, Matt Bai, how do you think this plays? First of all, why is Joe Biden saying that? And second, how's it play? Do voters now look at Obama and think trouble if there's a crisis or something else?
Well, and I'll add a question to that. Why does Joe Biden sound like one of those guys on the cop shows who's talking into a payphone with the thing,
really
with the voice-altering device?
Right, I'm sorry.
I don't know what's going on there. I don't know why Joe Biden said that. I think Joe Biden's a fabulous guy to watch. I think he really does connect with voters, but he does have a history of saying things that don't seem to have a rhyme or reason. And that is an interesting campaign pitch to make to voters. Elect us and you will get an international crisis. But look, I don't all of this stuff we fixate day to day on different comments or endorsements or this and that. All of these things are cumulative to voters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of noise and it adds up to something.
I guess that's my question. Do you think they see Obama as a nervous Nelly or a vulnerable?
It doesn't feel that way. The poll numbers don't reflect it. Conversations with voters don't reflect it. I think voters are reaching a judgment that John McCain, at least to this point, anything can happen. But the judgment seems to be that John McCain is not an agent of change in the way that Obama is, and that he will now say and do anything to head off the result. I mean, this is what happens to candidates who are losing late in campaigns, is the more you throw at the wall, the less impact any of it has, because voters tend to write it off to sort of desperation and tactics. And so at this point, I think McCain is reaching that kind of red zone in a campaign where the more he throws out there, the more they try to capitalize on momentary lapses or issues or things that Obama or Biden say, the less impact it's having. And I'm sure that's very, very frustrating, but it's actually a pretty common political phenomenon.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in the poll numbers?
Well, what we see is Obama poised for a substantial victory. He is 5 points ahead now in states. He's 5 points or more ahead in states with 318 electoral votes. He's ahead now in 12 red states, including places like Montana and North Dakota. Should he carry those states, all those states, he would get 375 electoral votes. McCain, by contrast, trails by double digits in all blue states except New Hampshire, where he's about five back. Why? What's happened? Well, I think Florida gives a clue. The Miami Herald today reports that just in the last month, there has been a 38-point shift among independents toward Obama away from McCain, just in the last month, the conjoint effect of the crisis, Palin, other things. And then you look further down in this, you know, for the future for the Republican Party, 70% of first-time registrants are for Obama. And then the Hispanic vote, the real future of American politics, consider these numbers. Obama leads by 53% in Colorado, by 44% in New Mexico, by 47% in Nevada.
That's a pretty big lead. Let's hear from Florida. You mentioned it. We've got Robert on the line from Tampa. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi. What do you see, Robert?
I just wanted to make a point about the foreclosures, and not all of them were people's primary residences. They didn't all represent people who overspent. In my particular case, between like 2005 and 2006, I bought seven houses as investment properties, and I bought them all with 20% down. I had an economic model, which was based upon 3% appreciation in our marketplace and 25% vacancies. And when the bottom started to fall out of the market, I didn't have the personal money to put up for them, and I was running vacancies closer to 50 and 75%.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of getting 3% appreciation, I got a negative 20% depreciation.
So you're in big trouble. How does that leave you looking at the world, Robert, at the politics, at what Greenspan said yesterday at McCain and Obama?
Well, I mean, failure is part of business. Failure is part of life. I mean, I don't blame anybody for it. I think I was conservative in my purchases, but I don't feel like I need a bailout. I'd love to not be losing the three investment properties, but I concentrated on paying for my primary residence and the properties that I could support.
You still got a roof over your head, Robert?
Say again?
You still got a roof over your head? Your own home is okay?
I do. I do, and I've managed to keep some of the properties that I had the best equity position in.
And how are you planning to vote in November?
I think it all depends upon how close it is. In the end, I'm an independent, and I tend to have libertarian leanings, so my inclination would be to vote that way. But ultimately, it's going to depend upon how I feel about the two that have the best chance in the end.
Well, that feeling time is getting right down to short hairs. Robert, thanks very much for calling. Nina, what do you make of the polls out there right now? Where Obama stands, word this week, it's right in Matt Bai's paper, New York Times, front page story saying they still see a way, Steve Schmidt, McCain's chief strategist. Do you, Nina, for McCain?
Well, you know, this is one of those campaigns, as any of us who sat through these election nights, particularly New Hampshire last winter, where you never say never. However, it's hard to see how he pulls it out. If you just take, let's take one state, Virginia. He would need to win Virginia. He could win Ohio. McCain could win Ohio and Pennsylvania, but if he didn't win Virginia, he'd still lose. And Virginia right now, he's 8 points behind in just about any poll, and which is astonishing. I mean, you look at, you know, Virginia, a state that's a real red territory, and he's struggling there. You know, I think, Tom, fairly or unfairly, a narrative has taken hold in these last weeks of the campaign since the conventions, and that is that Barack Obama is cool, calm, measured kind of guy, kind of leader. People trust him. This was, you know, a poll probably 2 weeks ago, I think it was, the Washington Post did this poll where to me that was a break point because it said that more people trust him as a leader. They trust their futures with him than McCain, that he had broken through that kind of commander-in-chief, you know, trustworthiness threshold that he'd been fighting. Mm. So anyways, I think that's taken hold, that he's cool, calm, measured, and John McCain is, you know, hot-headed, impulsive, erratic is the term. It's funny because this term erratic, I remember an Obama advisor used it with me back in when the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac crisis first broke. He said, "Well, you know, John McCain's acting kind of erratically," and they kept using that word. Well, it worked because it fit with people's perceptions of how John McCain reacted to the financial crisis. So I think partly because of how both candidates reacted to the financial crisis, and partly because of the debates, that narrative has taken hold, and I think it's really hard for McCain to break through. And the fact that the Joe the Plumber was sort of his last Hail Mary pass we saw, and that really hasn't had any impact. So it's hard to see how it changes at this point.
Mm. And now Barack Obama off to see his grandmother, even in these last days of the campaign in Hawaii, who may be dying. Let's go to Windsor, Vermont, and Victor. Victor, you're on the air.
Thank you. I want a leader. I think this country wants a leader, somebody who, and leaders historically have never led us at it from the place of scare. They've never led us from a place of fear. But they have. I want a leader who is surrounds himself with smart, experienced leaders, people who historically can make good decisions. I want one who has values. One of the biggest values that we have in this country, our family values. Here's a man who, at a time when most people were just plugging away with the business of getting elected, he's set his family values as a most priority and is going to visit his grandmother, who may not be alive in a couple of weeks. We don't know. But I think that says more of what we, of surrounding yourself with high quality leaders, thinking logically, and placing values above politics is a very important thing. That's what we look for.
Victor, we've got it. As Barack Obama flies to his grandmother, and of course we wish her well, you sound a little bit there like Colin Powell last weekend. Let's get to that before we're out of time here on Meet the Press, explaining his reasons for endorsing Republican Powell, endorsing Democrat Barack Obama.
Because of his ability to inspire, because of the inclusive nature of his campaign, because he is reaching out all across America, because of who he is and his rhetorical abilities, and we have to take that into account, as well as his substance. He has both style and substance. He has met the standard of being a successful president, being an exceptional president. I think he is a transformational figure. He is a new generation coming into the world, onto the world stage, onto the American stage. And for that reason, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
Matt Bye, it was a big endorsement. It got its weekend's attention and maybe more. Colin Powell, a pretty sober judge. Are people listening to that kind of opinion, that kind of view now?
Well, again, Tom, I think it's cumulative. You know, as I said before, I think a lot of voters now are trying to get their head around voting for Barack Obama. Whereas a few months ago, maybe before the financial crisis, they were looking for reasons not to vote for him, focusing on the differences, the cultural alienation. And as he said to me, it's not just race. She said to me, I've got a funny name. I'm from Hawaii. I'm younger. A generation is a huge part of this. I think now a lot of those voters are actually trying to get to a place where they feel comfortable. They have been for weeks now. And an endorsement like Powell's combined with a lot of other factors is very reassuring. I think it says to a lot of these voters, you're right to feel that way. You're not taking a huge gamble. You're not making a huge break with what would be normal for you, what you would have done in the past. I think all of that is cumulatively very effective and important for him.
And Obama has said, he said it to you, that he hopes for a country that he can take in a new direction, not just with a 1% victory, but kind of altogether now. Do you see any chance he's going to get that, Matt?
Do I think he's going to get on Election Day, you mean?
On Election Day or, and beyond, a country ready to, if it's him, come behind you know, a president in a less divided way.
Yes, I think people want to believe in a leader. What he does with it, we don't know. It's a significant challenge, and it's a very challenging policy landscape. But people want to believe in that kind of leadership. They're ready for it, and they're hoping for it.
Remarkable spot economically and politically to be in right now. Less, just a week and change before the election. Matt Bye with The New York Times, Nina Easton with Fortune Magazine and Fox. Jack Beatty, thanks to each of you for being with us. Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.